my gosh, I feel super tall right now. Ignore this. All right. I want to be all like super awkward. Okay, I'm Kara. I'm an alcoholic. And first of all, thank you, Damien, for asking me to come down and speak tonight. It's an honor and a privilege to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for you guys coming down. I had my little posse with me. I definitely volunteered Summer to do that 10-minute pitch without her knowledge, so I'm grateful she was okay with that. It is a lesson amongst my group that you don't turn down AA requests unless you have a really good reason. And she was driving tonight, so I knew she did not have a good reason to say no. And it worked out pretty well. So I'm really grateful to have had my girls here with me. And, you know, I just had a little experience during the break that just reminded me that we are everywhere. There was a young woman who came up to me, Maria, I'm going to call you out. She came up to me during the break and she said, "Do you remember me? I went through the House of Hope, and I know her from San Pedro, where I got sober, and I haven't seen her." There you are. I haven't seen her in years, and she's still here, and she's thriving, and the program is working in her life, and we get to see each other again, and it was just really neat. And I've had so many experiences like that where AA has just shown up in my life. I met professors in college who just happened to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been just weird coincidences where I just meet people when I just happen to need to meet them. You know, when I'm feeling a little bit outside of my comfort zone, like at a meeting where I know nobody, you know, just to know that there's a familiar face other than the guy I've met once and the people I dragged with me, you know, it was a really nice experience. And AA has always shown up for me. I just celebrated 6 years of sobriety on October 22nd. Thank you. I am extremely grateful for that. I had a really interesting, and I will say my home group is 52 from the Big Blue on Tuesday nights, just as Summer mentioned. And I've also recently been frequenting a Saturday night meeting. I'm obviously not there tonight, but it's Hope on the Hill in Palos Verdes, and that's where a lot of my other home group goes. And my sponsor's name is Abby. I've had her since I had about 2 months sober. She's taken me through all 12 steps and been an amazing guide while I started sponsoring other women, and it's been a great ride. I had an interesting experience the week before I turned six, and I was meeting with a friend who I'd gotten sober with. I mentioned I went through the House of Hope in San Pedro, and that was, I'll let you know what happened before that in just a few minutes, but I went through the House of Hope, and I was friends with this girl for the first couple years of my sobriety, and she moved home to Australia, and about a week after she moved home, she started drinking again. And so, but she's been able to do it, you know, like my hat's off to her. It's working for her right now. You know, we're both young. I got sober at 21. She was, I think, 19 when she got sober. And so she went home and she's like, "Yeah, I only lasted about 2 weeks and then I just started drinking," because AA just wasn't the same back there as it is out here. Another thing I'm extremely grateful for, Southern California. If you've tried to go to meetings anywhere else, we are so blessed with the number of meetings that we have out here. I think over 1,000 that somebody mentioned just in the local directory is incredible. So I had dinner with this girl. I haven't seen her in a few years, and we have dinner, and we're talking, and it's just me and her, and my schedule's been a little bit crazy recently, so I don't always get to as many meetings as I like to, and she's telling me how successful she's been at drinking. And I'm looking at this other young woman, you know, and she's in her 20s, and she's going through school, and she's doing great, and she's like, "Yeah, and you know, I just smoke pot once in a while, and I drink, and it's just not a big deal, and it hasn't interfered with my life." And I find my alcoholic mind going, "I could do that. Yeah, I could do that. I bet you I could do that." You know, it's been 6 years, yeah, you know, that I haven't drank. But, I mean, really, was it really the problem? And I start trying to run, and I'm an alcoholic. Like, let me be the first to tell you, I am an alcoholic. I have one drink, and I don't know when I'm going to stop next. I tell you, I'm going to be home at 9 o'clock one night, and I'm not home until 5 a.m. 3 days later. Like, I am an alcoholic, and alcohol leads me to very, very poor life choices. So it's like there's not a doubt in my mind that I have issues with alcohol most of the time, until I'm under-meetinged and under, you know, under a lot of pressure or stress or whatever, and I'm sitting across from somebody who I'm suddenly envying their drinking. You know, at that moment, those mental blank spots, they're not quite blank yet, but they're a little fuzzy. And so I spent the next week trying to figure out whether I could drink or not. And I'm going into my head, and I didn't call my sponsor. You know, I didn't call my sponsor. I was like, no, I got this. Like, I know. Like, Kara, you're not, you know, be logical about this, because I still default to logic. Like, I pray like crazy, but I default to logic because that's what I had my whole life. I was not a religious person. I was the girl who told you that you were stupid for thinking that God existed up until I got sober. So, you know, I'm sitting there trying to make logic out of why I can or cannot drink. And I went to a meeting, and I'm hanging out with, like, all of my crazy, somewhat vulgar, inappropriate, hilarious, sober friends. And I'm looking at all of them, and I just looked at all of them, and I was like, I couldn't be happy without you guys. Like, what is waiting out at the bar for me? I know the kinds of people who used to go to bars. Like, I used to be the kind of person who went to bars, but I didn't look like this. I didn't act like this. You know, there was nothing ladylike or polite or adult about me, you know, and I thought that suddenly I was going to be someone different. And so this starts to kick in as I'm looking at my friends, and finally I turn to God. You know, I just say God because it's easier. I still don't consider myself religious. I do believe in some kind of spirit of the universe, but I know when I say God, you all think of yours and I think of mine. So we're just going to roll with that. So, you know, I start talking to God, and I said, you know, help me to remember why I came into this program. Like, why did I come here again? Like, what was I feeling? What was that horrible pit of despair that I had in my gut? Remind me what it was like when I was sitting at home in my pajamas, teeth brushed, swearing I was not going to go out again. And all it took was one text message saying, like, hey, we're at the bar. What you doing tonight? And in my head, I'm thinking, nope, decided not to do this. And 5 minutes later, I've got, you know, my heels on, my hair is up. I probably haven't showered in like 3 days, but you scrub the teeth hard enough and nobody knows. And I'm walking to the bar. You know, I'm walking to the bar and I have no say in that. You know, those, all that stuff that I did in my first step talking about those times when I changed my mind about drinking, no alcohol in my system, and all of a sudden, a really bad idea turned into a really good idea. That is alcoholism for me. That is how it is defined in my body's chemistry, is that I have no choice there. And so I start reflecting back on all these things, and I didn't actually share about it with anybody until the night that I took my 6-year birthday came and went that week, and that Saturday, just a couple weeks ago, I was taking my cake and I shared about it. And I said, hey, so this is what I've been thinking about doing for the past week. And I think it is so valuable to have had that experience, because I need to remember periodically that I'm still really sick. You know, it's like that whole, you know, we can be recovered, but it doesn't mean we're cured. That whole thing. It's like, if I am not treating my recovery, if I am not, you know, putting ointment on the wound every single day, then that's going to slip. And, you know, that infection is going to come back. And I'm still going to be that sick, twisted mind that thinks that I can rationalize my way into being normal. And I know that that's not the case today, but it can haunt me really, really quickly. So I'll tell you a little bit about what got me into the program, what got me to the House of Hope on October 22nd in 2007. Dad's an alcoholic. Folks have always been split as far as I was concerned. They got divorced when I was like 8 weeks old, so I don't remember them together at all. My mom is of the type where if she has half a glass of wine, she starts to feel it and wants to stop. I'm like, no, that's when you keep going. Like, it's just getting good. And I always describe her best, because she had a Bud Light. It was after I had gotten sober. She had a Bud Light sitting in the back of her fridge. And I remember seeing it the first time I went over there when I was in recovery. We would have like weekend passes. And I remember seeing it. And I was like, oh, that's weird. There's a beer in the fridge. Like, I don't see beer anymore. And I noticed it. And then I remember seeing it again about 6 months later. And then I saw it a few months after that. And finally, I just turned to her. I was like, Mom, is that the same beer that you've had in your fridge this whole time? She goes, I don't know. How long do they stay good? And I was just like, I don't know. They didn't last that long around me. Like, that was never something. I never once checked the expiration date on a beer. Like, you bought it and you drank it. Like, you're missing something. I didn't understand. I still don't understand. She'll have like a bottle of wine open, and she gets good wines, and she's like, oh, I'm just gonna let it air out. And I'm like, mm-mm, just bottle the mouth, man. Like, no cup needed. You're just wasting time. And I don't get it. So my mom is totally the only addiction that my mom and I share is food. That was my first addiction, was food. That was the first way I self-medicated. I was a complete overeater. And when I was little, I was growing up, I was a heavy kid, and I got teased a lot in school. Little girls are absolutely vicious. I stand by that. I say it every time I share, because if anybody has a little girl, you know what it's like. You know, it is rough. And so, especially if you have even the slightest abnormality, and so mine was my weight. You know, like some kids made fun of the birthmark, but it was mainly the weight. It's like, you're fat, so we don't like you, which is just horrible. So I got teased a lot, and I internalized all of that. Like, I didn't know how to process feelings, but I started doing alcoholic behavior long before I had ever seen it. My dad was kind of just this figure, like, we saw him, but I don't really remember him being very influential. I remember my mom, because we lived with her mainly. She was my primary caregiver, and my dad ended up moving out to the Valley, so it turned into, like, the very stereotypical every other weekend and holidays when I was probably five. So, I mean, pre-5, you don't remember much anyways, but so I'm getting teased a lot in school, and so I'm taking my allowance money every week, and I'm coming home, and I'm stopping at the little liquor store, and I'm picking up a pint of Ben & Jerry's vanilla caramel fudge, and I'm going to the 99 cent store and getting just like a crap load of candy bars, because you can, they're like 3 for 99 cents, you know, so you can get a lot for a couple dollars. And so I'm going home, and I'm eating almost all of this. It was always the whole pint of ice cream, and then usually several of the candy bars, and then I'm taking all of it, and I'm wrapping it up in a paper bag, and I'm sticking it in the dumpster that's outside so that nobody can see. I'm hiding the evidence. I'm binging and hiding the evidence at like between 8 and 12 years old. That was just how I behaved on a weekly basis. Nobody taught me how to be sneaky like that. Like that, the fact that I know how to do that just on a core level, just of my existence, I know how to be sneaky like that, absolutely convinces me that I was born with this thing. Nobody had to teach me how to be an alcoholic. I was very good at it on my own. And so this kind of behavior is going on. And of course, if you're already heavy as a kid and then you're coming home and you're eating, guess what's going to happen? You're going to get heavier. And guess what happens then? You get made fun of more. So, you know, it's only perpetuating the cycle. And they have that whole saying, you know, like it's like having a headache and smacking yourself on the head with a hammer. You know, it wasn't doing anything. It was just perpetuating the cycle. And my mom could see how upset I was, but she didn't really know how to deal with it. So I'm just growing up, and I'm just getting angrier and more internalized. I'm eating more. I don't know how to process anything. And in middle school, I meet a girl who I had actually grown up with earlier in childhood, and she had developed really fast. Like, she looked like she was 16 when she was 12. And so she had had a lot of experiences that some 16 to 18-year-olds may have had by then, you know? Like, she was sexually active, she was partying, she smoked cigarettes, she drank. And I was like, yeah, you're cool, you know? Like, let's get to know you, because you seem like you've kind of, and she was the leader of the pack. There was this like group of us, and she was absolutely the dominant one. And so she introduced me to shoplifting and cigarettes. And for the first time, you know, like, we're going to Bath and Body Works, and we're just like sweeping stuff off the shelves into our bags. And I'm walking out of there, and I feel this high, this like adrenaline rush every time we got away with it. And so that turned into more shoplifting. And I was terrible liar. I've always been a terrible liar until I got really, really good at it later, but by then it was too late. But I was a terrible liar. And so I'd come home and I'd tell my mom, she'd be like, well, how'd you get all this stuff? Oh, they're having a great deal. Like, my mom never goes to the mall. And I'm telling her, like, oh, they had this great deal. Like, it must have been, I don't know. We got a lot of stuff, and I only got like $5 a week allowance. Like, no way I could be buying all this stuff. And I start stealing from my mom. I knew where she kept her change, so I'd go in there and I'd take all the quarters out of her big change bag. Like, she's not going to notice that there are no quarters, you know. And finally, I start getting even more sneaky, and I start trying to slip, like, actual cash out of her little, you know, out of her little wallet. Like, I didn't have anything important to buy. I wasn't doing drugs or anything yet, you know. So I couldn't buy alcohol. I was, like, 14. So I couldn't do any of these things, but it was just that rush and just knowing that I could do something bad and get away with it. And I stopped getting away with it. She caught on, and my dad came down. The only time they were ever in the same room was when one of us was in trouble. So it was me and my older brother, and so I knew something was up. And, you know, they pulled my covers, and if somebody could say, like, oh, that sucks, like, I got caught, maybe I should learn from this, and I didn't. It just started my hatred towards my mother. You know, and I had always kind of hated that she tried to control me, and the more she tried to help me, and she was probably trying to help me, but I just thought it was her trying to control me and her not understanding me, and so the more she tried, the further away I pushed her, and the further away I pushed her, the more she tried. So we were just, it was just a horrible balance between us, and so as I grow up, I start trying more and more things that are helping to make me feel adventurous. At 15, I legitimately try alcohol for the first time. I'd had like wine or whatever at family gatherings and things, but I try vodka. and it burned like hell going down. It did not feel good. It did not taste good. I didn't like anything about it. I was like, this is like rubbing alcohol. This is disgusting. And I just remember thinking, this sucks. But I had actually, I was hanging out with the daughter of one of my dad's Alcoholics Anonymous friends because he thought she would be a good influence on me. But it turns out she snuck out at night and partied with all the older boys in the neighborhood. So that's what we did. So we snuck out and like they gave me vodka, and then we were in this garage. And it was this little back room, and I swear to you, Half-Baked was on. People were getting stoned. Someone was making out in the corner, and they're passing around cigarettes and Smirnoff Ice. And Smirnoff Ice, these days it'd probably mess me up, which is about how I was then. But I had, I think, maybe two, and I was done for. You know, I just felt like crap. I felt sick to my stomach. I was smoking cigarettes. It was all smoky in there. And I remember going to bed that night just thinking how horrible I felt. But there was something else that stuck with me, and that was the fact that I had sat in that room and nobody had judged me, questioned me, asked me what I was doing there, called me fat, looked at me sideways. Nobody. It was just like, hey, here's a cigarette, you know, smoke it or you'll look weird. Here's a Smirnoff Ice, smoke, like drink it or you'll look weird. Like they didn't say that, but I understood you're doing that, so I'm supposed to do this. So I just mimicked. And they didn't judge me at all. And I was like, oh my God, this is how you get along with people. I didn't go and start drinking all the time after that because most of my friends did not party like that. I was in band in high school, so I wasn't hanging out with, like, the rebels or anything. But me and my best friend did find the one guy in band who smoked cigarettes, and we made sure to make friends with him. And I started a nice little cigarette habit at about 16 or 17. And, you know, and I just started turning away from school. I started hating trying. My parents kept telling me I had potential, and it kept pissing me off. And I was like, you know, if I can get C's and graduate, then what the heck is the point of trying for an A? You know, like, why would I ever do that? So I barely graduated high school. I got a job waitressing, and I discovered the restaurant crew, you know, the restaurant parties. If you've ever worked in a restaurant, you know that people like to go out and they like to drink. And so I was introduced to drinkers, and we would go out after work and we would just get hammered, and we were going in hungover. You know, we worked at TGI Fridays at Torrance, and we would just party. And along that path, I got introduced to some pretty rough outside substances. I will just suffice it to say that I would rather be up than down. So I was introduced to some things that helped me be up all the time. And the longer I could be up, the more I could drink. And if I drank and I felt too down, I could just be back up again. And so I was introduced to some things, and it started a few years of just complete assault on my body. There were, I think that my story is a little bit backwards in some senses, that my physical bottom was a long time before my spiritual bottom was. My physical bottom was those first 4 months because of some of the things I was involved with. It was like not eating for, you know, weeks at a time, not showering. And I was, you know, 40 pounds underweight and just really, really bad condition. And I came out of that, and physically, I was doing a lot better for the next few years. But spiritually, there was just a little part of me that just started to disintegrate. And it was that hole that I talked about in the beginning that I felt before I got sober. You know, it was just this little piece that was just like, eh, I'm not happy with myself, so I'm going to try to do something to make myself feel better. But then the more I tried to make myself feel better, the more self-will I exerted, the bigger that hole got. And I thought that I was just doing the wrong things, so I just kept trying harder and harder. And when I got here, it was so hard for me to understand that I needed to try less. That was such a backwards concept for me. People were telling me, like, you just need to stop trying so hard to control everything. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. I've been trying to control things and failing this whole time. So obviously I've been doing something wrong. And it's like, yeah, you've been holding on to the reins. It's not yours. You know, it's not your show to run. And I just did not understand that. And so I'm out there and I'm trying all these different things. I get in a relationship with Mr. Wonderful, you know, just drinking more than I've ever drank in my entire life. We had some really awful things happen in our relationship. There was a month period that I like to share about because it was one of those months where it's like, how did you not see that there was a problem, you know? And it was February, it was Valentine's Day. I found out we broke up on Valentine's Day. I found out I was pregnant. No, we broke up on the 13th, found out I was pregnant on Valentine's Day. Got back together, well, started talking to Mr. Wonderful again on the 15th because it was his birthday, but didn't tell him. I was still using and drinking at the time and smoking cigarettes. So I was getting sick to my stomach every day. My parents said they weren't going to raise a child for me. I decided that I was going to have an abortion. So I had one on March 1st of that year. I got back together with Mr. Wonderful, told him what had happened. And we decided to start partying again. And so I started getting back into the drinking and the using that I had sworn off for about 5 days so that I could have this procedure done. And a few days later, we're going on a 24-hour fishing boat because he worked as a deckhand. And coming back from that, we went to go pick up some outside issues in San Pedro. And we get this horrible car accident going too fast off of a freeway off turn, flip his truck a few times and total his truck. And he gets out of it and he's like, oh, man, I may have missed that speed limit sign, but I didn't miss this one. You know, look what we were going to do. We're so grandiose. He's like, look at what we were going to do. Look at what we were going to pick up. We have to stop doing that. And I was like, okay. Bumps and bruises heal up. A few days later, we're back out picking up more of what we intended to get that night. And about 5 days later, I turn 19. So that was the month prior to me turning 19. And I looked back at that month. I look back that month now and I see how chaotic it was, but I looked at it then and I was like, wow, there was a really unfortunate series of events there, you know? Like, it just did not occur to me that, like, hey, maybe this guy is not the best influence on you. Hey, maybe your life is spiraling out of control. It was just like, wow, that was rough. How can I forget that as quickly as possible? Oh, I know. Let me shove some substances in my body. So that's what I did. And I just numbed myself out for the rest of that year. My mom found out we were doing some outside issues at one point, and so I ended up quitting, finally. And as soon as I quit doing the outside issues, I realized the relationship I was in, and I was like, I hate you. Like, why am I dating you? You know? And it was just so clear that it was just such a horrible relationship. So I got out of it, and a few months later, I always end up in these relationships, and so I end up dating this guy, and like, for the first time in a few years, my life is actually starting to turn around a little bit. Like, I'm holding down a job. I'm dating this guy who seems a little bit more normal, but he likes to drink. And I'm starting to have this really weird experience because I wasn't old enough to drink at the time. I was, like, barely about to turn 20. And I start having this interesting experience where we're out at meals and he's ordering drinks. And I'm, like, mad at him for drinking. I recognize that now as envy, but I didn't know that then. I was just like, God, why do you have to drink all the time? But if we were at a party and he wanted a drink and also give me a drink, I was fine with it. I had no problem with him drinking then. But it was, like, upsetting me that he could drink and I couldn't. And so that's just Kara's little alcoholism sneaking in there and starting to rear its ugly little head. So I start dating this guy, and he used to tell me that there was something about the end of his relationships where as soon as him and a girl broke up, they got fat and their lives fell apart. And I used to think that was like a really cold thing to say until we broke up and it happened. It's like within the first few months after we broke up, and I'm sure it had nothing to do with him. He broke up with me because I couldn't control myself. You know, he was just like, this is not what I signed on for. You know, like, I'm not happy with the way things are right now. Because I was lying, I was cheating, you know, I was like not being a good girlfriend by any stretch of the imagination, and he didn't want that. And so a few months later, I find myself getting pulled over in Torrance, and I was planning on partying with my friends, and instead I'm getting arrested for possession of some substances you're not supposed to possess. Over the course of the next year, I decide that since I was arrested for those substances, then, you know, I had to go to these other 12-step meetings, but they weren't for alcohol, so I could just leave those meetings and go drink, and technically, it would be okay still. So my drinking just really shot through the roof in that next year. I wasn't the type of drinker who drank and didn't eat. I was the type of drinker who drank and ate everything. So over the course of the next year, you know, I defaulted. I defaulted to emotional eating. I'm sad, I'm depressed, so I'm going to eat food. And I put on just a lot of weight, and I just remember thinking about that, and I was like, son of a gun, like, he told me this was going to happen, and it did. You know, they sentenced me. I had a pristine record before I had gotten that arrest, like, not even an unpaid parking ticket, you know, nothing. And so they had sentenced me to Prop 36, and I had been put on, like, level one, which is, like, the lowest level, because I had nothing. I had gone sent to drug court, because I took the position of a user instead of a dealer, and because they were like, you had enough, like, I won't even go into that, because it's too much about outside issues, but they thought it was too much for one person to use in one night, and I was like, you don't know my friends, and so, but I got to take the position of a user, and so they sent me to drug court in Prop 36, but the problem with that is that I don't know how to show up when I'm supposed to show up, and I don't know how to follow directions. So the night before I meet with the $7,000 lawyer that my dad loaned me money for, that I still owe him money back for in my charming financial amends, you know, he loans me money for this lawyer, and the night before I go meet with my lawyer, I'm out till 3 in the morning drinking with my friends, and my mom's freaking out because she thinks I'm not going to show up. She told the lawyer, too. She's like, guess what she was out doing last night? She just doesn't understand. It's like, and that, of course, made me hate her more. I hated my mom at this point. I didn't hate her, actually. It was just, you know, that frame of mind where it's just like, God, like, you just don't understand. I just thought nobody understood me. I was, like, the only person to ever feel like this ever, and it was just the worst thing in the world, and I just couldn't get it together, and so I meet with this lawyer. We start the whole court process, and I was sentenced to an outpatient program, and it was like, you know, minimal. I had to check in with a probation officer or whatever because it was a felony, and I was supposed to go to this outpatient, and I missed my first intake, so immediately I go from level one to level two. So already outpatient's going to be harder than what it's supposed to be, and I finally make it to my second intake, but then I'm not always showing when they're supposed to be giving me, you know, urine tests because it's not clean, and I know that, so I would just rather ditch it, which counts as an automatic positive. If you skip it, they're just like, okay, well, we're assuming you're guilty because you are. And I'm going to these, and I just cannot keep it together. I get back together with Mr. Wonderful, who I shared that 1 month of just supreme awesomeness with, and you know, we're not doing the really hard stuff anymore, but we're doing the kind of hard stuff because we've learned to rationalize that, and now I'm 21, so I'm like, it's legal. Like, you can't tell me the drinking is my problem. I had no idea I was an alcoholic until I had been in recovery for a good couple months. I really struggled with that because it's so legal and it's so accepted, especially in my age range. It's just like, this is just what you do. You go to bars, you party, you have a good time. Like, what did you do on your 21st birthday? I went out to a bar. Like, why would I not? Just like I bought cigarettes on my 18th. Like, these are the things you do. And I just thought it was so socially accepted that there's no way it could be wrong. So I ran with that, and I just absolutely ran my soul into the ground that past year. I started doing all the things I swore I was never going to do, you know, the drugs I swore I'd never do again, the people I said I'd never sleep with that I slept with, you know, the places I said I'd never go, never experience. I did everything I could possibly do to degrade myself 100%, very thoroughly in that past year. And I started coming home on these nights. I was living with my mom. You know, I was puking in the toilet in the middle of the night because I'd wake up spinning. And always telling her, oh, I just had tequila tonight, or I just mixed this and this. Like, it shouldn't have been that. I always had some excuse. And I know now that my dad was in the background that whole time talking to my mom and saying, like, you know, she might be one of us, referring to alcoholics because he's in the program. And she was just like, no. She didn't want to believe that, you know, her little girl could have a problem like this. And so I'm having these experiences where I'm coming home and, you know, I'd make sure my mom wasn't home, but I'd go and I'd look at myself in the mirror and I would just be so disgusted by what I saw. I was like, what is wrong with you? And I started slapping myself across the face as hard as I could because I remember seeing people do that in the movies and it always seemed to shock them into, like, awareness. You know, like, somebody gets slapped and they're like, oh my gosh, I've snapped out of it. So I would just, like, reach back my hand and I'd just crack myself across the face and I'd be like, it didn't work, you know? So you'd do it again and, like, it was just not working. And so I resorted to other things. Like, I was always afraid to actually, like, cut myself because I thought that might hurt. But I would just, like, dig my nails into my arm, just drag them down my arm. And then I would wear shirts that you could kind of see it in because I was hurting. I was so lost at that point. And I was so scared that I didn't know how else to process these things except to, like, kind of show you. Just kind of. But I didn't want to say, like, hey, I'm really effed up right now and I have no idea what to do because I don't think I even recognize that. I just knew that there was this horrible feeling and I didn't know what to do about it and nothing was working. So this goes on for that final year, and I finally had 3 dirty tests at my outpatient treatment. And one of the counselors there, this woman Jody, another small world story about her in a second, but this woman Jody sits me down and I denied. She was like, well, you know, your test came back dirty. And I was like, no, I didn't use. Like, of course you used, you know. And so she sits me down in this little room. And she's like, Kara, I know you because I've been you, you know? She's like, I've been there. I've been that scared, hopeless little girl who comes home at the end of the day. And she just completely pulled my covers. And I just remember sitting there in tears. And that was my first experience of one alcoholic talking to another, just that complete identification. And I was like, oh, my God. And so I turned to her and I said, you know, it was dirty for a reason. I used. And she goes, I know. And I actually, like, duh, you know, and so I ended up having to choose between going to jail or going to a residential treatment program, and I had done a lot of my initial wrongdoings in San Pedro during those first few physically depleting months of using really heavily, and I had stolen from somebody who told me he would kill me if I ever came back to San Pedro, which is how I ended up not in San Pedro anymore. And when I said, where am I going for recovery, they said, you're going to the House of Hope in San Pedro. And my first thought is, I didn't even know they had recovery in San Pedro. And the second thought is, there is no way in hell I'm going back to San Pedro. What if I see this guy? What if this happens? What if that happens? And I was just in so much fear. And there was just no question. There weren't even options given to me. It was just like, nope, you're going here. And that's it. That's final. You're going there, you're going to jail. I don't know how much jail time I even had as an option. It was just not, I spent one night in Torrent City with some girls who were way too comfortable there, and I swore to myself that I would never be back. Like, I was the girl that was crying and freaking out, and they were just like, oh, it's probably her first time. And I'm like, how many times have you been here? Like, this is not okay with me. You know, this sucks. Like, I'd planned on partying tonight. Skirt, tank top, hair curled, you know, like, it was just bad. So I promised myself I'd never be back there. So jail was not an option. I go into this residential treatment program, and the final week before I go, I made sure to really get my party on. My last drunk was not drunk at all. It was two glasses of wine with my mom and my brother. It was like their send-off for me. It was two glasses of wine, and we had spilled a glass earlier, and I remember those two, holy crap, really? Oh my gosh, okay. I don't think I can talk any faster. ooh, it's all hot. So we have those two glasses of wine, and we had spilled one earlier, and I remember thinking when I had finished those two glasses, there was nothing left in the bottle, I remember thinking, like, God, that really sucks. You know, that sucks. If we hadn't spilled that one earlier, I could be having another one. Again, something I did not recognize as that physical allergy, that craving, I did not recognize that until I got sober and started learning about these things. So I walk in the door, stone cold sober, on October 22nd, 2007. It was a Monday because they had offered it to me on a Friday, and I said, nope, don't want to spend the weekend there. So I went in on a Monday, and that started my sobriety. And I was living with 24 women. We were getting up at about 6 o'clock every morning to do chores. I had to learn how to make my bed because I had never done that before. You know, I had to learn to clean up after myself. We took turns cooking for everybody. You know, it was a communal environment. We all took care of each other. And we were going to about 5 classes and 1 12-step meeting every single day. And all of the 12-step meetings were Alcoholics Anonymous except for 1 NA meeting. I decided after a while that I was more of an alcoholic than a drug addict. I absolutely know without a shadow of a doubt I'm one of those too, but alcohol started and ended everything for me. It was the first thing I tried and the last thing, you know, I had, and it carried me to all of those other substances. So I start learning about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I start hearing about God, which really freaks me out. Like, I used to hate standing in that little circle and saying the Serenity Prayer. I thought I was going to throw up the first time I saw somebody doing that, because I was like, oh my God, like, this is what I'm going into. I'm going to be holding hands with all these chicks. Did not like girls. And I have to, like, be friends with these gals and say these prayers, and it's just, it was too much. But you know what? I started saying those prayers, and I started holding their hands, and I started being friends with those girls because I didn't have a choice. It never occurred to me that I could, like, leave. Like, that was just not an option for me. It was like, no, you're going to stay here, and you're going to learn this. And I get this sponsor who starts helping me with the whole God thing. And, you know, I start having all these epiphanies along the way. Like, there's a part in the book somewhere kind of early on that reads something to the effect of, the alcoholic builds up a bright outlook for himself and his family and then pulls the structure down on his head with a senseless series of sprees. And the first time I read that in a big book study, I went, oh my God, I'm an alcoholic. And I made a little note like, tell mom. And so I called my mom, and I called her after that class, and I was like, mom, I'm an alcoholic. I swear to you, she goes, no shit. I didn't know. So it was an epiphany to me. And I start working with a sponsor, and she starts explaining the whole God thing to me. And we just start working the steps. She's like, why don't you just work step one and then worry about 2 and 3? And I said, okay. So I worked step one and realized that without a single shadow of a doubt, I'm an alcoholic to my core. All those things I was reminding myself about the week before I turned 6. And I start working all these great steps. And I go into 2, and I start getting to dissect what I want my God to be. I start getting to dissect my former understanding of him, and I start getting to get into connection with what it could be. And what I'm taught is that my God can be anything I want it to be. It doesn't even have to be the same thing every day, and it's not. I have called my God Father. I have called my God Friend. I've sometimes just looked up and been like, WTF, you know, like, I don't know what's going on all the time, but I trust that there is some kind of force working in my life, because every single time I've come up against a wall, that car accident I was in, that abortion I had to go through, the guy who said he was going to kill me and decided not to that night so that I could go home and get out of that, I've had something watching out for my back for so many years, and I've always been so ignorant of it because it scared me to think that something could be controlling my life that wasn't me. And the longer I stayed sober, the more that I realized that the more I let go, the easier my life was going to get. And so I start hitting my knees and saying my prayers just like my sponsor directed me to do. And I start talking to this God every single morning and every single night, at the very least saying, help me and thank you. I start making gratitude lists. I start realizing how much is just beautiful in my life, how much my family cared about me, and how I shouldn't hate them, how I should accept that they were loving me the only way they knew how. My mom's love for me was her trying to control me. My dad's love for me, which he was taught in the program and Al-Anon, was to give me my distance. I got to go to family groups with them at the House of Hope. We got to sit there and air all of our dirty laundry. My dad said he walked out of there one night feeling like he had darts in his butt, because my mom and I were just like, bam, here it is. And he said, what do you need from me? And I said, I just want to start over. So since then, I've gotten to build a beautiful relationship with my father, who has relapsed two or three times in my sobriety, who I've gotten to reverse the tables on. He had 10 years when I got sober, and we've gotten to give each other a variety of cakes, and it has been a wonderful experience. And every time that he's slipped, he has not hesitated to call me and say, honey, this is what's going on. And I get to love him the same way he loved me, saying, there's no difference between you and I. My mom has gotten to come to a better understanding of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that it doesn't have to be a curse for me, that it can be a blessing, because I get to come and meet amazing people who have this really great structure to their lives that pretty much everybody on the planet could use, but only so few people are privileged to. Like, I meet normal people, and they'll be going through situations, and I'm like, have you prayed about it? You know? Like, I don't say it, but I'm thinking about it. Like, oh, the Serenity Prayer would be great for that, or the Bridge Prayer, you know? And I just want to, like, I want to throw Alcoholics Anonymous at them, but I don't, because not everybody comes from that. So I try to teach sneakily, you know, like, have you tried just maybe letting that go, or thinking about things that are going well in your life? Gratitude list, you know, like just trying to sneak my program in there. And for the most part, it works really well. I've gotten some amazing opportunities. I did work all 12 of the steps within my first year. I started sponsoring right away, and I have not been without a sponsee since. I have four right now that are absolutely the light of my life. I've got one on her 12th, one on her 9th, and one on her 6th and one in her 4th. So that was the first one to make it all the way to her 12th, that one that's on it right now. And now she's dragging her feet. I'm like, finish! Like, this is like an accomplishment for me too. Just finish it. So people don't always make it. There's a level of willingness that I had. When my sponsor said do it, I didn't think to say like, no. You know, I just did it. And so when I have a sponsee who's unwilling, I'm like, you can do it the only way I know how, or you can find a different sponsor, or you can keep drinking until you're ready to do it my way, you know? But I have had enough willing sponsees that I know what that looks like. I know what that hunger and that willingness looks like. And, I got to hold one of my best friend's legs, actually, while she was having her first child. I got to hold my grandfather's hand when he was passing away a couple years ago. That woman, Jody, who was the first person to have a heart-to-heart with me, I actually just saw her at a House of Hope fundraiser recently. Haven't seen her in about 5 years. And she goes, oh, my God, you're still sober. And we just got to have that moment. And my whole family, there was some really bad beef between me and my brother when I got sober. We hang out. We chat on the phone. He calls me just to say hi. I have this amazing relationship with my entire family today that is so far beyond anything I thought I deserved 6 years ago that it just blows my mind. And every single day I get to wake up to that. I have a job that they just promoted me at. I guess I'm promotable today. You know, I'm going to have my bachelor's degree in 3 months. Like, it's just insane to me what I've been able to do in sobriety. And it is all because I apply these principles to my life every single day in every single area that I can. And I forget and I screw up and I almost forget that I'm an alcoholic sometimes, but I have a lot of really awesome people around me to remind me. And if you're new and if you're scared, welcome. So were all of us. You know, nobody came in here and was like, score, Alcoholics Anonymous. So just give it a chance. I promise you, at some point, if you work this and you're ready, at some point you're going to wake up and be like, cool, I get to go to my meeting tonight. It stops being have to and it starts being get to. And that's been a really amazing transition for me. And I really, really hope that I don't ever have to give that up. So thank you for having me tonight.